Hello.
Hello.
How are you?
Oh, I can't stop yawning. It's great for podcasting, I'm sure.
Well, you know, could be better.
Could
CBB, as they say, in the industry.
In the industry. Nobody has ever said that to me, by the way. I guess I'm not a real professional visual effects artist because nobody has ever used the abbreviation CBB in anything I've ever worked on. Oh. Or if they have, I just fully didn't know what it meant and ignored it.
The first time I ever got that note was 2005. And that was my first job.
Wow. You would think in 14 years you would figure out how to make your stuff better, but that's all right.
It's just been the same note. I'm still working on that shot.
You've been trying to work on the same shot of Smurfs 1 or whatever the hell came out.
No. It was Lion, Witch, and the Wardrobe, The Chronicles of Narnia.
I almost doxed your email address there.
Oh, don't do that.
I wasn't going to do that.
But that was a situation where I had to, you know, learn on the job. Just ask, like, very politely, what does CBB mean? And then you find out, could be better. And you're like, well, then what does that mean? Do I work on it? Like, do I work on something else? Like, how
it is, rather obscure note, isn't it? It's just like, oh, if you got a little bit of free time, throw in some effort here and there.
Yeah. If you have extra time and budget, as this is spiraling slowly out of control, quickly out of control, then please go ahead and, you know, push some buttons over here and make sure that this thing is just slightly different. But I have to say that I wish you could get CBB notes on some other projects where it's just like, no, we need to have exactly this vision of the director and or executive producer depicted here. And it's just like, but that doesn't, it's not important. It doesn't make any sense. And this shot is less than a second long.
I wish I could give CBB notes on like sandwiches and stuff. Because I feel like it would really be useful there for people to know, like, you know what, this was satisfactory, and I ate it, and I'm no longer hungry, but really could have been better. Maybe I'll write that next to the little tip line there. I'll give him a couple of bucks, and then I'll say CBB.
Yeah, inform the sandwich artists of the world.
I feel like they're probably more self-proclaimed sandwich artist than there are designatees of the sandwich artist title from that one place where you should never get a sandwich.
Mm-hmm.
I think they have that trademark is what I'm saying. I don't go there.
Okay.
Yeah.
It's very specific.
I don't like to eat fresh is what I'm saying.
All right.
In a manner of speaking.
Yeah.
Oh, God. What time is it? Is it like 2 a.m.? What time is it?
So it's not so much fun when you have a full work day to go watch a movie and then immediately talk about it as if you can't possibly rest for 2 seconds.
No, there was very little downtime. There was a very big accident on the way home, so it took like an hour and 20 minutes to get home from work. And then it was just like, I ate a gallon of hot and sour soup and some white rice, and then I watched a movie, and now I'm here. Not a literal gallon. It was probably, I don't know, whatever those other large tubs are the soup comes in.
They usually come in like a quart.
It looked larger than a quart, but it might have been a quart.
Yeah, it's the round cylindrical plastic thing. They usually puncture a hole in it, and then they put inside of an ineffectual little thin plastic bag.
It was tall, so I feel like it was
I think it was a quart.
I feel like I know what a quart is. Isn't a quart is about as tall as it is wide?
You were thinking of a pint, sir. Also, you can put a pint into something that is not as tall as it is wide, etc.
Well, yes, obviously, but I'm talking about, okay, look at that. It is a quart, heavy duty deli container, 32 ounce quart. There we go.
You can buy them in bulk.
I drank a quart. I didn't really drink it. I ate it with a spoon, but I consumed a quart of hot and sour soup.
I don't really love hot and sour soup.
Oh, I love it so much. I want to bathe in it.
Ugh.
I want to come from the multiverse where everything is made out of hot sour soup.
Oh, God.
So I can just eat whenever I feel like it.
That would be the worst. All right. So speaking of the multiverse, we should mention that we are talking about 2018's Spider-Man Into the Spider-Verse, a movie that is animated and is a Sony Pictures animation affair. And why does that matter? Because Sony is an intensely bureaucratic entity comprised of multiple divisions that do different things. So this has no connection to really the Marvel that you see depicted in the live action movies these days, the Marvel Cinematic Universe, as it were, or the X-Men Cinematic Universe, or even really the Sony Pictures things, although they do make references to the Sony Pictures movies.
Yeah. This is not the Tom Holland Spider-Man. Mm-hmm. It's referential to the Toby and not really the Andrew Garfield one, but it's in the same world as the Toby and the Andrew.
Well, it doesn't take place in that world. It just has references to it. Like the car through the window thing.
Yeah.
Like that was Spider-Man 2. It was a big famous thing.
Except he didn't punch it in that movie.
Right, exactly.
He did a flip.
It's totally different. And then also, this is a universe where you have the PDNY, the Police Department of New York.
Well, are you going to skip right over the finger gun dancey Spider-Man 3?
Oh, yeah. Well, that was also a fantastic reference. Because that was a much derided part of Spider-Man 3.
It was so bad.
Yeah, it was
Didn't somebody on Twitter do a side-by-side of the Spider-Verse version and the real version?
Oh, I don't recall seeing that, but it wouldn't surprise me. They basically like Lord and Miller have done with other projects, namely Lego Batman, or the Lego movie, but mainly Lego Batman. They have an appreciation for a wide variety of sources material, where they look at the whole thing, all of the things, and they say, hey, you know what? Let's just all come in for a big group hug. And so they do that. And that's kind of their modus operandi.
They're just really high at a buffet and they're just taking bites of everything.
Yes.
And they're like, oh, it's so good because they're high, but somehow like it works.
Mm-hmm. Yeah. And they're at Taco Bell. They're the combination Taco Bell, KFC, Pizza Hut.
Oh no. I don't think there's enough mind-altering drugs in the world for that. But I was going to say the Taco Bell near my office has these like little touchscreen kiosks now. So you can just like, you can hit the button, you can customize your food, which I don't know why you would customize it because it's Taco Bell. And then you can pay with Apple Pay real fast. And then they just call out your name. Like you don't have to talk to people. It's pretty great.
Wow, it's perfect for millennials. But not Rye, though. Unfortunately.
Although hilariously, the kiosks face the opposite direction. Like they're right next, they're directly across from the actual people that would take your order. So you're just standing with your back to them, like 4 feet away, while you're using this kiosk, and they're just staring at you.
I have a question.
As you tap. Huh?
Did you use this kiosk, or did you observe the kiosk?
No, I recently used the kiosk because I have limited lunch options.
I do
enjoy getting out of the office, and I was like, you know what? I'm going to go get a quesarito. And then there was a line, and I was like, you know what? I don't feel like waiting in this line. I'm going to tap a couple things here and Apple Pay on the thing, and it's going to be good to go.
Yeah, well, that's kind of like my Starbucks mobile ordering, because I will never wait in a Starbucks line again in my life unless the mobile ordering thing goes down for some reason. It really makes the whole process go a lot more smoothly because I don't need to do anything. I can just walk in and there's a thing and it has my drink there and then I can walk out again. At first,
but you don't have the opportunity to stick your face on the glass with like the pastries in it and go, that one looks all right. Can I have one of those?
I would never.
I like croissants.
No.
I like cheap croissants too.
No, but they're not. Oh, those croissants are so bad, Dan. They're not good. They're not flaky.
They are flaky. They're incredibly flaky. Ask my shirt and the inside of Amanda's car. They're very flaky.
They shed. They're not flaky.
They're flaky. They're stretchy in the middle and they're flaky on the outside.
Yeah. It's just
just like somebody with psoriasis. No,
it's a greased dough that falls apart in your hands. It's not.
It sounds delicious. Who doesn't like greased dough?
No, we didn't really have a mobile ordering experience when it came to Spider-Man Into the Spider-Verse, because this is a situation.
Did you try to keep us on track?
I mean, there's a lot to talk about in this movie, so I don't want to like run into any problems here, where we have a 3-hour podcast about it. But there's this is a movie where I when I first saw the thing of it, the initial teaser trailer, where not much is teased or trailed, I was very skeptical of it. It seemed like a cheap cash grab. It had Avi Arad involved as a producer again. It had the story of Miles Morales, who a lot of fans at the time, and probably still, feel like deserves a live-action depiction rather than an animated one. And so there's some skepticism around that. Also, I watched the trailer on my iPhone, and it looked like all they did was turn off motion blur for the stuff that was in that trailer. Keep in mind, that was the initial teaser trailer. Later trailers are better, and it revealed more of the complex work that went into making this. And you watch the movie, and it really reveals layers and layers and layers and layers and layers of artistic work that has gone into very short shots, long shots, all kinds of things. Like, there's 2D embellishment of stuff that's happening in these scenes. There's very complicated procedural work in order to create certain kinds of effects that look like they're 2D. There's all sorts of thoughts about, like, how you're going to deal with depth of field and sort of give it a sort of printerly effect, where you make it look like it's sort of an out of register printing when it's out of focus. It's a lot of stuff that went into this. So my initial rejection of the teaser trailer was unwarranted, and might have mainly had something to do with me being jaded by my former employer producing Spider-Man content.
You're never going to forgive them about anything ever, are you?
No. See, okay, listeners, as I said, I worked on 2005's Chronicles of Narnia, The Lion, the Witch, and the Wardrobe. That was my first job, and I was at Sony Pictures Imageworks, and I was so excited to work there because I had seen Spider-Man 2, and I thought it was amazing. I thought Spider-Man 2 was one of the like best movies ever. Like, what an amazing way to approach this. Like, the amount of work that went into it. They won an Oscar for that. It was,
which who was the bad guy?
That was Doc Ock. That was Alfred Molina. Yeah,
he was. Who was the number one then?
That was
just Goblin.
Yeah, that was just Goblin.
Huh.
Yeah. Number two was Doc Ock, and then number three, I had this weird interview process at work where I was already working at the company, and then I got to go talk to my potential CG supervisor and interview for basically a job inside of the company, where I could be an artist on this project, because there was a lot of interest, and so they could be selective about which artists they wanted to allow into the project. And I had only worked on Chronicles of Narnia, Lion, the Witch, and the Wardrobe, and Open Season prior to this, so not a huge resume, and there was some skepticism. And I did the interview process with a CG supervisor, Bob Winter, who was no longer at the company but was there at the time. And I went on to work on Spider-Man 3, and the excitement on getting to work on Spider-Man quickly tapered off, like fast, like real fast, like a lot, real bad.
What were you working on primarily?
The Birth of Sandman sequence was what I was primarily tasked with. And for those who are unfamiliar, at the time, Sony Pictures Imageworks was a render man place, and that was all not ray tracing, because render man at the time was very bad at ray tracing. It's better now. And that you were basically dealing with shadow maps and particles and stuff. And so it was a lot of things of resolution issues, and you would just basically be running tests to see how many particles you could cram in and make it look like sand. And you just did that for 6 months, and it was, it really just destroyed your morale. And then after that, after the oopsie doopsie of that one, I got the pleasure of working on the Amazing Spider-Man movie, which is the first Andrew Garfield one. There were some other movies in between, but don't worry about that. So I got to work on the Amazing Spider-Man movie, and that one was on a team with a different CG supervisor, and we were primarily tasked with the scene where Spider-Man is swinging towards Oscorp Tower, and then when they're on the rooftop at Oscorp Tower at the end. And I was doing lighting, and this is when Sony decided to split up work between lighters and compositors, because prior to that, they basically had lighters and the lighter compositor task was one job. So you would render your thing and you would composite your thing. You were responsible for both. And there were some flaws with that, because some people were not very good at the compositing part, but were very good at the lighting part. And some people were very bad at the lighting part, but very good at the compositing part. And it made it hard to recruit people. So this was an attempt to split it up. So I could only do the lighting, and I had to feed my lighting stuff off to other people to do the compositing. And that was annoying. But after that experience and the sort of lukewarmish reaction to that movie, I went to do Amazing Spider-Man 2. And I was on a different team for that. Well, I was laid off in between. But then I was on a different team for that one. And I was working on Electro stuff with a different CG supervisor, and I was tasked with compositing rather than lighting. So I couldn't, frustratingly, light any of the stuff. I could just sit there and wait for renders to come. And it was a very different experience for me. And that was also its own mess with Electro. And trying to deal with all that stuff. And that movie was not well received and killed that. And then they went to go do Spider-Man Homecoming. And I was so over Spider-Man at that point that I didn't watch Spider-Man Homecoming until it was like available on home video because I was just done with it. And
it was a good one. Mm-hmm. I watched it a few times. I feel like it. There's a lot to enjoy about it. But then after about the second time, it drops off dramatically.
For Homecoming?
Yeah.
Yeah. Yeah. Yeah. I don't, it's fine. It's good at what it is.
I found the SonyPicturesMuseum.com and we have the Amazing Spider-Man 2 Electro Skin Shot Build, which I believe is one of the shots that's on your reel, the close up of his face.
I don't know. There were many of those shots where he's inside that little cage thing.
Yeah.
Talking to Dr. Strangelove.
But you worked on 3 Spider-Men. That's impressive.
Yeah, but just the bad ones, Dan.
Well, they were all bad ones until very recently.
Yeah, but that's what I'm saying. It's like Spider-Man 1 was good and well-received by many people. Of course, the standards were different at the time. So if you watch it nowadays, it's not quite as sophisticated as you might be expecting. Spider-Man 2, also good. Again, same condition. But I didn't work on either of those. And then I didn't work on Homecoming, which came after, and I didn't work on Spider-Verse. So I only worked on the bad ones. It's a nice icebreaker when somebody asks you what you've done, and you can say, I only worked on the bad Spider-Man movies, and they know exactly which ones I'm talking about. But
well, I don't know. I mean, mm-hmm. I know there's a lot to say about those original Spider-Man movies, but I was never super into Tobey Maguire. I know he did some good things, and he embodied the character appropriately in some places, and what's his name directed the movies relatively well at some points.
Sam Raimi.
Yeah, Sam Raimi. Yeah. I mean, there are still moments just where I find it difficult to suspend my disbelief when watching Sam Raimi and Tobey Maguire being Spider-Man. But yeah.
Sam Raimi was not a Spider-Man.
Well, he was. I'm sure he was bad. I imagine him behind the camera, like Tarantino in Pulp Fiction, where he's like doing the hand moves and like mimicking stuff. Because you know,
or like Ang Lee in the Hulk movie, where he was doing the mocap for the Hulk.
Was he really?
Yeah. Oh. There's a video of that. You can watch it.
I kind of want to see that.
Yeah, that's it. That was unwise, especially allowing the filming part.
Ang Lee, Hulk mocap.
You don't need to look at it now. But the
I don't need to, but.
It was a situation where I think my expectations for Homecoming were low. My expectations for Spider-Verse were incredibly low. And then I went in to watch Spider-Verse in the movie theater. And at first I was a little like, no, I don't know if I'm down for a whole entire movie full of this. And by the end I was like, that was amazing. Please give them the Oscars and things. And then let's do more wacky experimentation stuff, like
specifically the style.
Well,
the graphic novel style. Well, like all of the things that they did stylistically.
Stylistically, it's interesting because it's not 3D stuff in the past, notably video games and some like TV stuff that they make to show for kids. It has a has tried to pull off toon shaders and stuff like that, where you take 3D geometry and you're just like, oh, I can do an edge detect. There we go. We're all done. And then you show that off and you're just like, look, I made a 3D thing that's a 2D thing. You have all the advantages of this and none of the plus sides of the other thing. It's fantastic. So they have done that kind of stuff in the past, and it would be a disservice to say that they're doing that here. Like, this is not attempting to make something that's, strictly speaking, two-dimensional. It uses two-dimensional concepts as 3D texture for the environment that it has made.
There's the 2D rendering of the 3D objects in places, and then there's also additional just like straight up 2D animation elements added on top of it, which all works together really well. They use so many different techniques together. Like, you almost can never get tired of one particular technique.
No, yeah, and at first I was a little uncertain, especially at the beginning of the movie, where you're just like, is this going to hold up, to keep layering all this stuff on top, like no motion blur, offsetting the animation?
All they did was turn off the motion blur.
No, well, that's not what they did. But they animated on twos, ones, twos, and threes, and what that means, I've tried to explain this in the past to people, is that when you're animating on ones, you're animating for every frame that you're showing on the screen. And every frame that you're showing on the screen is 24 frames per second. So that's 24 drawings or renders of frames. And then when you're doing it on twos, you have every other frame. So that's 12 drawings spread out over 24 frames, or 12 renders spread out over 24 frames. And if you're doing a threes, do the math, people. You can figure that one out. Download pCalc. But the
is it eight? I think it's eight.
It's a good guess, Dan. But they have some difficulties with doing that kind of stuff, because you also have this fluid camera movement and motion that's occurring. And if you try to do stuff on twos, it's going to look stroby and weird. And
right. This is a Lego movie thing, too. Mm-hmm. I don't know about you, but I was surprised how many people were like mad at the strobiness of the Lego movie stuff.
My favorite thing about the Lego movie stuff is that some people thought it was stop motion. With dum-dums.
Yeah, they're like, oh, it would have been so much better if it just wasn't for the, you know, the stop motion look of the whole thing. It's like, well, what? No, that made it cool and fun, and they did all kinds of like fun animation tricks with that too.
Yeah, and that was Animalogic in Australia, I think.
They are in Australia.
Yeah,
yes. And, well, they probably have a Canada location too. Everybody has Canada location.
Everybody's got every location. Gotta make the money off of your tax incentives so that you can give it to your clients and sacrifice your work and morale. But whatever. The situation here with Spider-Verse is that you are layering all of these things in a way that makes sense. So you do have stuff that's animated on twos, but it's with stuff that's not animated on twos, or you're adding these smears. If you go like frame by frame through something, you can see the smears, where they're basically taking, like, if someone's flailing an arm, they're like smushing an arm, like smearing it across the frame and stuff. And so it's not the same thing as if it was motion blurred, but it helps ease some of what would be a stroby effect if you were to just literally look at it as something that was just out of the render, everything rendered on twos.
Right. Like there's smears, there's like duplications to sort of imply motion blur. It's like a really low, it's not samples. What's the word I'm thinking of for like time blur?
Yeah.
It's samples, right?
Well, time blur is more of like a frame blending thing, isn't it?
I'm just like take one frame and then scatter it across two or three frames or whatever. So it's just like you get three different arms as it flies through the air, but of like different opacities or whatever.
Yeah. Also, they did that too, where you're having like unique geometric things that are appearing only on frames in order to like fill in those gaps where it's not like connected to the body, but like all of a sudden there's like two arms and or several objects or text floating in the air, etc. And so it really helps with the richness of the world because it doesn't feel like it's a comic book, but it feels like it's a three-dimensional animated feature that's informed by a comic book.
Yeah, it's interesting. It feels like they really went kind of restrained on some of the you know straight up 2D elements, you know, like the explosions and then like the text that like you know the screeching and the bagel and the bamf whatever kind of stuff.
Everybody loves
and
the bagel.
Lines. The bagel's very good. But then again, you've got the legitimate 2D stuff, but then it's combined with a lot of 3D stuff that's sort of rendered with that toon shading 2D look. So it feels 2D until you actually see some 2D stuff and you're like, oh no, this is still 3D stuff. And then all of it is still, it's all lit very well. And they've got a, like a very massive saturated color palette at times. And it's especially with the glitch effects, which I thought were really cool. Cause that's the kind of stuff that in addition to being like misregistered, comic books with three color printing, it's just like awesome, overly saturated, cool looking stuff. Oh, didn't you say that, the filmmakers were sad and complaining that on Netflix it's apparently way desaturated.
No, there was an assistant editor on this who tweeted and then deleted his tweet. So I don't want to call him out.
Oops, sorry, I totally.
Yeah,
I did it.
He there had been some implication that it's not as good as seeing it on the Blu-ray. I don't doubt that it's not as good as seeing it on the Blu-ray because that's just the nature of the beast. It's always going to be better to watch it on a Blu-ray, but unfortunately, that's not an option for many people, practically speaking, in their priorities in their lives. So they're not going to get the ability to do that. Also, the best way to see it is really in a movie theater. And so I tweeted a lot about that way back when because I was like, I don't know what the F this is going to look like on home video. And it looks, you know, fine. But just imagine you're sitting in the middle of a movie theater and your entire field of view, especially in that end battle thing, is just taken over by wacky, insane, saturated, fluctuating stuff that's happening. Everything you can see is just that. There's no living room. There's no glare from the lamp. None of that stuff. It is... very interesting to see it that way. Yeah. So if they ever do like a, if you ever somewhere where they're having like a theater that's doing like a, oh, we're going to show the thing, then go watch the thing. But, I think it's better that you see it at all, rather than, you know, skip it. So, it's on Netflix in the US and I don't know how many other territories. I'm not responsible for checking that. So don't at me, bro. Go do your own research. I would say that it's also worth purchasing, not the least of which because I've purchased it on two occasions. But it still holds up well if you have a reasonably good television and you can sit in the dark. It's not going to be the same experience as the theater, but it's better that you watch it than you don't, and you'll get the general gist of it. Just imagine it bigger, louder, more around you. It is.
I almost wonder if it's. Because there is a fair amount of, you know, your standard sort of animation techniques of squashing and stretching people beyond what they would actually do for sort of animated comic book style motions that on a big screen, it would almost kind of be a little overwhelming, I would think, if everything is moving around like that and crazy saturated cool colors.
Well, some of the movements get strobier on a projector. At least I felt... I don't know. It could be crazy because I felt that some of it was a little more intense, especially I think it's hard to get adjusted to it at the beginning of the movie because your vision is not calibrated for it. So I think that's the part that I got hung up the most on when I watched it in the movie theater and when I watched it again here at home. But then you start to get into things by the time that Peter B. Parker shows up in the movie. Then you're sort of on board with everything and the way that it's functioning. But I think there's definitely a calibration process for your vision to get adjusted to what it is that you're seeing. And so you do maybe notice some stuff. And it's also part of the movie where not that many fantastical things are occurring in the opening scenes. There's a lot of like very normal life stuff happening, so it can seem even weirder for some of the motions and stuff to be so exaggerated, because there's nothing like really far-fetched about what's happening. But
one thing about the story in general, when you're talking about the beginning not really having a lot of crazy stuff, this movie being an hour and 56 minutes long or whatever, it really did not feel very long to me. And maybe it's because there is a whole lot of stuff going on and they have to get from plot point to plot point to plot point pretty quickly, because you have to not only establish the characters and the world, his world, and then how he turns into Spider-Man, and then the combining of all the worlds, and there are so many things going on here that it's just like, wow, that was a really quick 2 hours, and suddenly it's over.
Yeah, it's it is definitely not something that it doesn't slow down at any point and get boring and dull. It just keeps going the entire time it's going. And I'm led to believe that there is material that was cut from this that would have made it an even longer movie. Much is the case with, you know, your Lord & Miller productions. And I should say that while Lord & Miller were producers on this, and Phil Lord was he has a story by credit and a writing credit, along with one of the other directors, Rodney Rothman, Lord & Miller did not direct the movie. And you had three directors directing this movie. We had Rodney Rothman, Bob Perschetti, and
Peter Ramsey.
Yes,
I don't know any of these names.
Well, they've been around in animation for a while, but I think, as far as I know, this is the first time they've directed a feature.
Rodney Rothman, writer on 22 Jump Street.
Yeah,
I like the Jump Streets.
Yeah, I know. Well, that's why I kept trying to get you to go see this, because I was like,
I know, I kept trying to go see it, but somebody else who goes to see movies with me was just like, eh, I don't think it really looks that good. It's like, I know, but I've heard it's good, so we have to go see it. Mm-hmm. And then suddenly it wasn't in theaters anymore.
It's crazy how that happens. Yeah. People are not respecting the theatrical experience these days.
Actually, it might not be that it was out of theaters. It might be that Avengers was in theaters, and it's like, well, we're going to see one movie in the theaters. We got to go see this.
Yeah. Well, so... Anywho, anyways, this is an interesting movie, and I also know, speaking of people who are working on this, I also know that one of the CG supervisors, Ben Hendricks, I worked with him and then for him on Spider-Man projects in the past, and he's a CG supervisor for lighting, so... You see all the forest stuff that happens when they're at the Alchemix lab. He was the lighting supervisor for that stuff that's happening there. And then the guy who was the animation supervisor for the movie, Josh Beveridge, I went to school with. I don't chit-chat with him. And the last time I saw him in public, it was one of those situations. Have you ever had a situation where you know somebody, but it's been a while since you've talked, and so it seems like you're both like not going to talk, and so then you just kind of are in public a ways apart, and then you move away, and nobody says anything to the other person?
I can imagine that, yes.
Yes. So that happened. That's fine. We weren't friends or anything, but it's... It's interesting to note that you know, Ringling School of Art and Design, class of 2005, Josh Beveridge was the animation supervisor on this. So that's well deserved. He did a good job supervising. And if you go on the Twitters, you can find that a lot of the animators on this project have been tweeting their reference videos and stuff for the animation studies that they did in order to achieve their stuff. I think there's Nick Kondo and a bunch of other people. And they've been tweeting up a storm about all this stuff. And there's Justin K. Thompson. He tweeted a bunch of stuff initially and then got real quiet. But he was the production designer on this. I don't know him at all. But he had a bunch of interesting stuff on there. So you can scroll back through his Twitter and find things. And Daniel Pemberton, who did the soundtrack for this, which I also think is really interesting. He has a bunch of very interesting behind-the-scenes videos about how they made the sounds that are in here, because if you notice, it's a sort of a textural, atmospheric wonderland cacophony of things happening. It's not specifically just an orchestra, and there is a lot of your turntable stuff happening, but then there's layers of other things, like the Prowler has that weird electric elephant noise, and like there's a lot of stuff, and so it's interesting.
Was the Prowler a thing before this? I was unfamiliar.
Yeah, see, I was unfamiliar too, and apparently he's a thing, but he was like a, I don't know, Z-tier kind of villain, and he was a Z-tier villain in like the normal Spider-Man stuff, and then when Marvel did the Ultimate Spider-Man comics and the Ultimate Universe and stuff, where they were reimagining things, that's where Miles Morales comes from. You had a different version of Peter Parker there, and you had Miles Morales there, and that was by Brian Michael Bendis, and Miles Morales' uncle was the Prowler. But
I saw B. Bendis in a cell phone as an Easter egg.
Yeah, and he's you know, it doesn't really have anything to do with anything. One of the things that I found frustrating on my first watch of this is that I didn't notice them say the Prowler's name until like when he was almost dead.
Way later. Yeah.
I was just like, who's this purple guy? Because you can figure out all the other ones.
It's just like an angry metal Spider-Man with a cape and a hood thing.
An electric elephant noise.
There are a lot of really good Easter eggs in this movie, too. I'm looking for a more comprehensive list of all of the stuff that's in Times Square when Nick Miller shows up. Because you got all the... Oh, God, where did it go? There's all of the movie posters behind him. There's like a Seth Rogen movie where he's like riding a horse or something.
Yeah, there are so many layers to this. And the more you rewatch it, the more stuff you pick up on. That is for sure. Like there is.
I was just looking at the image. Where the hell did it go? It was so good.
There was a reference to Cloudy with a Chance of Meatballs, the florist nivifer, the thing that makes all the food. It gets sucked into the little vortex thing at the end of the movie, and you got your other stuff for like the names of like the Coca-Cola products and stuff are different, and. You've got your other references like on cell phones or Danny Dimion, the visual effects supervisor for this production, who was my CG supervisor on the first Smurfs movie. He was Danny's a really nice guy. He actually has a cameo where apparently they had a model of him at the Kingpin dinner at the tower. The weird tower dinner thing, and he's just there and he claps briefly, but that's the kind of like weird Easter egg that like literally no one would get.
I love all of these posters. So Seth Rogen's movie is called Hold Your Horses, and he's sitting on like a sea biscuit. Oh, you have there's the Chance the Rapper where he's wearing the four hat instead of the three hat. Apparently Steph Curry is a golfer. In this, there was what is this? Where's the Shaun of the Dead poster? From Dusk Till Shaun. I like that one. That's pretty good. This Planet Hollywood sign looks like it says Planet Inglewood, which I'm not sure.
It does.
Anyone would want to go to. What is the one beneath it that looks like it says Baby Shark?
Oh, I don't know that one.
It says Baby SH, and it's like the, I don't know, it looks like a girl group or something.
I don't know about that one. Yeah, no, the Planet Inglewood is definitely one I saw. Yeah, there's so many layers to this movie. I applaud all of the work that went into it. And I was wrong to doubt people.
It was a really nice looking movie too. All of the still frames in this thing too. Like you could pull, I mean, again, I guess part of it is because there's ostensibly no motion blur that a lot, like basically every frame you could pull out and turn into like an awesome poster.
Yes. Yes. Yeah, you totally can. And we should probably briefly talk about the movie. I don't know.
Very briefly. Yeah. So basically all of the is the Spider-Verse story itself from the comics, or is it just really that they took all of the comic stories and then combined them in this movie?
There is a Spider-Verse storyline in the comics. I didn't read it, but I have been informed that it exists. And
that's probably more like what they do at the end there, where they say so-and-so weird spider-looking guy has a button now where he can travel between the verse on his own.
Well, they're like meeting up to stop some, like, I don't know, energy vampires or something. I don't really remember.
They're not strong enough to do it on their own, so they decide to extra help.
There are these, like, the energy vampire things, immortal things or whatever, are like jumping through the different multiverses to consume Spider-Man's energy things and the different...
Is it Skrulls? Are they Skrulls?
No, I don't remember. See, I listened to somebody explain it to me, and I don't remember what it was because it was just so nonsensical. Like, I take no issue with them not doing anything like that for this. I think that this works fine, what they did here.
I was actually really happy with the way that they decided to bring people in through the multiverse stuff, because you think it's just going to be like, oh no, science experiment gone wrong and suddenly we're all here, but they managed to bring them in one at a time in a way that actually works, and they timed it such that Miles is just discovering his powers, he meets Peter Parker dies, spoilers, and then, you know, we meet Peter B. Parker, which I think is a hilarious name because he's just the you know, the B-team version of Peter Parker, and then all of the other
ones
sort of filter through.
Peter B, like B-E, Peter B. Parker. Mm-hmm. He is Parker.
Be the Parker that you were meant to be. Also, what was up with the gigantic Green Goblin? It was like Godzilla.
I see, that's the weird thing. It's like, it was one of those things where I was like scratching my head. I was like, I don't know about this one, but apparently I think that was something to do with in the Ultimate Comics line, they had a version of the Goblin that was more like that, I guess.
He was interesting.
Yeah,
but it's cool the way you get to you meet Peter B. Parker, you meet Gwen Stacy, and then I like how they're like, we can't continue doing this for the next half hour of the movie where we slowly introduce people one by one. So once you finally meet Aunt May, she's like, oh, by the way, there's three more here, and you got Noir Spider-Man, played by Nicolas Cage, which is pretty great. You've got Anime Spider-Gal, and then
Penny Parker,
and then you've got Spider-Pig,
mm-hmm.
Peter Porker, which is John Mulaney and is fabulous and serves no real plot purpose in the movie.
No.
But I'm just so glad he's there. He gets one scene where he's like, oh yeah, I'm going to do this, and I'm going to pull a giant hammer, wooden mallet out of my pants and hit you with it because I'm a comic, a cartoon, and that's what we do.
Yeah, well, and see, that's one of those things where it's like, you might initially think like, oh, well, what if this was a live action movie? It would suck. Like, do you want to see Spider-Ham like in the real world?
No, but they've managed to take a lot of, like, you know, you look at the 21-22 Jump Street movies where they have a lot of just like moments where you could tell they're sitting in a room going like, what would be a really silly funny thing to do here? Like, okay, maybe the they think they're going to inspect drugs, but it's actually an octopus that jumps out and latches onto his face and starts inking into his mouth. Like, that's hilarious and completely nonsensical, but they managed to take a lot of like weird little bits and pieces like that, and it works here in an animated sort of comic-y Spider-Man movie because there's humor, and while there is a plot line and a thread through the whole thing, you get away with murder and with just weird stuff that you're gonna do here. Like, I love the scene where he's discovering his powers, and he's just like, he's like tripping and falling for like five straight minutes, like in rooms, out of rooms, on the side of the building. Like, he loses basically all of his clothes, and then he's like walking on the outside of the building, and Gwen Stacy sees him. She's just like, okay, that's interesting.
Yeah. Well, see, and this is one of those things where it starts off in such a vanilla way where you get the many, many production logos, and then you start the movie with Chris Pine's voiceover because he's Peter Parker.
I had to look it up too. I'm like, who is that?
Yeah, I couldn't identify it when I first watched this movie either. What's really amazing is there is actually a holiday Christmas album that you can listen to where Chris Pine sang all these songs.
Oh, he specifically? That's not referencing something older?
No. I have no idea if that's a reference to anything, but they just
did it. What about the cereal? Is there Spider-Man cereal?
I don't know about that one. But this sets up an important mechanic, which is the unveiling of a character's spider history up to that point, because that comes into play many times the rest of this movie. So you gotta start off top here with that. And so you get this sort of summary of Peter Parker's life and him fighting various villains. And this is where you get like the montage of things you may have seen from the movies, right? And also the popsicle.
The popsicle, right. Yeah, it's great too, yeah. Because it's like, this is all of the stuff from the Sony movies that we're familiar with, and we're like, great, yes, we're on the same page. Thank you for fast-forwarding through all of this. We understand it. But they do it, you know, for every single character, and they get a progressively faster version of the whole thing. And like, oh, I see the slight differences in how they came to be how they are, because, you know, the obvious question is like, hang on, what universe are you from where you're a little anime girl and you have a robot spider thing? And it's just like, well, okay, this is the year 3000 or whatever. And then you've got, you know, Gwen Stacy and all that stuff too. So I like that they give all the origin stories, and again, they just fly through them, but you can see just enough of a difference between the universes that you're like, okay, cool, I can go with the fact that Gwen Stacy is Spider Gal in her universe.
Yeah, and you need to set up this... You do a longer version of this montage, and then you increasingly make it shorter and shorter and shorter through the production of this film, because you don't really need a long, detailed, you know, montage for Spider-Man Noir and Spider-Ham and Penny Parker. Like, they get sort of a summary thing all joined together, because what they have makes no sense, but you know the shorthand for what they're explaining because you've seen the montages occur several other times. And then you get another long montage to bookend the movie, and that's with Miles at the very end. So it's a good mechanic in terms of storytelling to do this at the start. It's not just funny. And so you get the popsicle and all that other stuff, and his responsibility to the world. And then you get your introduction to Miles, and he's, you know, kid.
He's just a regular high school kid in a world where Spider-Man has been around for a long time and just doing his thing. He's like, yeah, Spider-Man's cool. He's admirable. We look up to him. His dad, Miles' dad's a cop, and he's not super thrilled with Spider-Man working outside the law, but he's just trying to make his way through. He's in middle school too, right? Like, you're watching this, you're like, wait, really? Middle school? And then he's spray painting on walls, and he's got his uncle who's apparently on the outs with his dad for reasons that we're not particularly aware of in the beginning here, aside from the fact that he hangs out at home and is totally cool with enabling Miles to just like skip class and not do his reports and go spray paint on walls, which is, you know, I guess it's important to have the, you know, the cool laid back uncle, but maybe don't take most of your cues from him, especially because he might turn out to be a bad guy with metal claw hands.
Spoilers.
Sorry.
But I mean, I knew something was off about that relationship when I was like, this is too nice of an apartment for him to have here and stuff, and to you know, be so cavalier about the law and things, and the falling out between him and his policeman brother. And it's like, so something else is going on. I didn't specifically know it was the Prowler, but something else was going on. But so anyway, the start of the movie, and you get introduced to Miles, and he's packing for school, and you're like, this is weird, like a suitcase. And then you find out that he's going to basically a school where the kids stay there for the entire week and then go home for the weekends. So there's like a
dorm
room. Yeah,
that was
room.
Confusing too. It's like, is it a boarding school? But like, no, he can also go home. I mean, maybe he could just go home because he's in close proximity to where he grew up or something. But yeah, it was a little confusing to me. I assume that's a thing from Miles's comic.
Sure. I don't know enough to correct you or to confirm. But it did strike me as weird when I watched it as well. And
it seemed unnecessary that he had to have a dorm room. I guess the dorm room was important that they had the, you know, the separation from him and his parents or something, but middle school and suitcases, it was weird.
Yeah. I have to imagine there's some other reason other than, you know, just trying to keep them separated, but Anyway, he goes to school and he walks past his old school and he really likes it. And then he goes to his new school and he doesn't really like it. And he didn't want his dad to drive him to work. And then he trips and then there's a cop car. And then, uh-oh, it's his dad. He's in the cop car. And this is where you find out some of the tension with him and his dad. It's like he doesn't think his dad is cool. He doesn't think that his dad is all that great and he doesn't really appreciate him. And so Miles goes to school and he goes through his normal school day where he's late for everything and is underperforming.
He's in an advanced school. He's trying to keep up. Everyone else is smart too. He's kind of overwhelmed and yeah, he's late and not making any friends. He tries to make friends and he can't, even though all of his, he was apparently very good at making friends at his regular school, and that's partly why he wants to go back. But he finally makes a dumb joke that's funny enough to get one person to laugh, and that happens to be Gwen Stacy. And he's like, oh, hey, cool, I have a friend now.
What's funny is she says that she only laughed because it was so quiet.
Yes.
not because it was funny.
that's totally something I would have slash definitely did do in like high school. Just like, I laughed because it was quiet, and then the fact that it was quiet and I laughed and it echoed so loudly made me laugh even harder, and that kind of just like accelerated itself for like 15 minutes, and I was just like crying with laughter in the middle of a silent room while people were trying to take a chemistry test one time, and it was really weird.
It's a very strange story. You really not need to tell on a recorded medium, but
I still don't understand how or why it happened, and I apologize to the teacher the next day. I'm like, I don't know what that was all about. My assumption was that there, you know, a truck drove by one of the classrooms and a lot of like gas fumes came in, and maybe I got a little lightheaded or something.
Were you high, Dan, doing the drugs?
I was not high. I did not do the Mary Jane in high school.
So
wouldn't have known where to get it if I wanted it.
There's the thing where he meets Gwen, and then at night he's like, screw all this, and he goes to meet Uncle Aaron, and they hang out and then go to his cool underground subway thing that he knows about from some contractor job or engineering job or whatever it was.
Which was cool, and I thought that was going to be a reference to Amazing Spider-Man 1, 2, whichever one is the one where he has the like secret thing in the subway with the tokens.
That's the first one.
Yeah.
But they go down there and they're spray painting and stuff, and then we see a spider and it's glowing and it has a number, so you know that there's at least something a little different about it. And that spider, you're waiting the entire scene for it to bite him, and it does. And then there's the comic panels of blood cells changing, and then he just swats it off gently, because I feel like that's the kind of thing that Lord and maybe Miller and these directors potentially are known for, is like, yeah, there's this really heightened thing, and then we're just going to like diffuse it with like a whatever.
It's like the getting ready for prom in 21 Jump Street, and then suddenly they have to go mow the lawn because they live at home.
Right. And so they dismiss the spider, and he goes back and sleeps, and there's like one of those time lapse montages where you see the light changing through the window with his roommate doing computer stuff all night. And then he wakes up in the morning and he puts on his pants, and his pants are too short, and then he starts having like little thought balloon things. Not thought balloons, but like the little the boxes, the little dialogue boxes. And
comic internal monologue things. I like the way you mentioned one of the time lapses here. I like the way that they use both like traditional sort of time lapse looking stuff. They have the multi-panel sort of comic book look where they can montage some stuff. Again, they just have so many techniques that they can draw from because they've established this sort of like hodgepodge of 2D, 3D comic book cinematic style that they can just, whatever best serves the narrative, where they're like, all right, we'll cruise past this and show that he went to bed and woke up and suddenly he's taller. And it's pretty fantastic.
Yeah. This isn't your daddy's Pixar movie, where everything has to like make logical sense. You can just grab whatever you want from the art bucket and then do the art. And, they do. And so, he has like some panic from this. And he's going through, experiencing a lot of internal
also,
monologue.
I love that he's like, my pants are too small. I gotta get some new pants, but like he doesn't have any more and he has to go to class, so he just wears his tiny pants.
Yeah, he's a man priest. He's freaking out increasingly over the course of all of this, and his internal monologue is freaking him out. And then he runs into Gwen and accidentally sticks his hand to her hair. in a pretty funny scene.
He does the shoulder thing that Uncle Aaron said to be real smooth and hit on her. And
hey.
She's like, okay, you're weird. And then he has Spider-Man puberty and his hand sticks to her hair, which the whole thing is hilarious too with like trying to disconnect. He's like, I'm just going to pull really hard. She's like, no, don't do that. And then she just like does like a full Street Fighter like throw of him, which apparently doesn't work because the next shot is like them in the nurse's office and they're cutting her hair off and he's just got hair glued to his hand and it just looks hilarious.
Yeah. And it's also funny because his panic, his puberty panic, it's funny because it's there's a certain truth to like not knowing how you're talking to somebody and like not being able to figure out who you are and how your body is reacting in that certain time frame. So that was all pretty funny. And I like when she says, I think you don't know what puberty is.
This one little scene here is kind of what all of the Tobey Maguire movies were, which it was just like, who am I? What am I supposed to be? Why don't I understand these changes in my body? I have hair growing in funny places. Well, not so much that one, but
I can shoot white stuff out of my body. But
no, that was in a purchase in this universe.
Yeah, so
doesn't come with the original.
No. He can't do that. He also freaks out again, and then like he's crawling on the outside of the building, and he's going to the security office, and he's going to his room, and he's totally freaked about everything, panicked, and doesn't know how to handle this. So he happens upon a Spider-Man comic that sticks to him from his roommate's collection of comic books. And
this is one of the best devices, especially for this part in the movie, where because he lives in a universe where Spider-Man exists, and then suddenly, I mean, because obviously, like, it's kind of amazing that in the Spider-Man universe, they have all of these spiders, and it's established that there's all of these genetically modified spiders or whatever, and one of them bites him. But like, what happens to all the rest of the spiders? There's more of them. But he uses the Spider-Man comics as like the blueprint of like, well, what did Spider-Man do when he first discovered he had powers? And he's like, oh, look, he's had some of the same things. Like, what did he do next? Well, he took a leap of faith and jumped off of a really tall building. And he's like, all right, I'm going to do that. He's like, no, I'm not going
to
do that.
Yeah. Well, also, he decides to go find the spider that bit him the night before because he knew it was a spider. But he's like, it can't be a special spider or anything. And so he goes to the underground subway station thing, and he finds the spider corpse. He's like, totally enormous spider, and he pokes it with a pen and it glitches, and then he freaks out by it. But then there's some noises that he goes to inspect, and he quickly finds himself in the middle of a battle between the Green Goblin and Spider-Man, fighting in the super collider thing, because Spider-Man is there to turn it off. And what's a super collider, you might ask? And it's a sort of dimensional thingy, my Bob, that's going to do stuff that does dimensional things, interdimensional things. And
this is what Doc Ock was making in Spider-Man 2, right?
No, this is the power of the sun in the palm of your hand.
He was making a power thing.
Yes,
that's right.
It's fusion, and you can drown the fusion in a lake. But anyway, so that's it's not important.
Yeah, heaven help us if the sun accidentally ever falls into a lake.
I think it was the plot of Sunshine. But
is that one that's like a Firefly that all the nerds like but everybody else hates?
No, Sunshine is the Danny Boyle movie where they...
Right, yeah, all the nerds like it, but nobody else does.
But it's not like Firefly. I don't know why you're saying it's like Firefly.
It's like Firefly in that nerds like it and everyone else thinks it's silly.
It's not a really good measuring stick.
Yes, I agree.
Yeah, because there are many reasons not to like that movie. But so anyway, sorry, Danny Boyle, don't listen to this podcast.
It's one of those the sun isn't rotating, so they need to shoot a nuclear bomb into it or something.
It's like the core for the sun, but more serious. It's very takes itself very seriously.
That'll make an elongated cylindrical ship to drill to the center of it that can detach into small pieces with little doors in between them.
Well, in a way, they wind up in that in that sort of situation. And it also
is there a journey to the center of the sun?
Yeah. And also, you get a little dash of Event Horizon thrown in with some Looney Tunes people.
Is hell in the middle of the sun?
No, not quite. there's some poor choices. I think if you ever want to be, if you're ever like, I don't feel anything right now, like kind of like Spider-Man Noir, and instead of like burning a match in your fingers just to feel something, I highly recommend just watching Sunshine so that you can be angry. It's like Snowpiercer in space.
I don't want that.
So anywho, back to this movie. They have the stuff that's happening. Where the collider is going off, it zaps some things. Colors happen. Floaty dot things appear, and you get Kingpin in his little control booth, and you're like, wow, that's an interesting shape of a human being, where his head is sort of like floating in the middle of his torso.
It's kind of a big trapezoid with a face on the front.
Yeah, it's a very graphic and interesting design that I like, and I like the clicky pen. But we have the multiversey thing, and then Spider-Man's head gets dunked into it, and that's what sort of seems to cause the other spiders people to be drawn into this universe. Then the collider shuts down, and there's a whoopsie doodle, and Spider-Man's not feeling too well. He's coughing, and he's like, here, take the override key and go do the thing. I can count on you. And Miles is like, uh-oh, I better hide. And he hides, and then Kingpin and some of the other henchmen show up, and Kingpin murders Spider-Man. And then Miles is like, well, this is bad.
Yes, but I really kind of enjoyed, I mean, not enjoyed or whatever, but like, I like that Kingpin's plot was not just like, and then I'm going to hold the city for ransom. If they don't give me the money, I'm going to open a multidimensional portal and destroy everything. Like, he had a plan that was for self-gain, but it was for like a personal reason, and I thought it actually worked really well. Like, you understand his motivation. Misguided as it may be, because, you know, he lost his wife and son because they ran out on him because he's a psychopath and he was trying to murder Spider-Man. But, like, it's his fault. He's trying to, like, rectify that by pulling his family in from another dimension. And you totally get that. You're like, wow, that's totally a very reasonable thing that a bad guy with a lot of money would do in the Spider-Man universe. And I'm on board with that. And you're kind of, you know, you're rooting for him, but you totally understand what he's doing and also why it can't happen.
Yes, and you don't get it all, like, dumped on you in one scene. Like, Spider-Man just says, like, it's not going to... I saw what you're trying to do, and it's not going to work. You can't bring them back, and blah, 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 blah. But that's, you know, more comes along later, where you find out who he's trying to bring back and why. And you have a lot of moments where he says, like, it's not about the money, and you can't take it with you, and stuff like that, because... he has all this money from all of his illegal crime stuff, but it's not making him happy because he doesn't have his family. There's a weird thing going on there about how he wants to have that family back. So Spider-Man dies, and then everybody's sad, and we're all like, uh-oh, dead Spider-Man. And there's a funeral and stuff and things. Miles escaped the Prowler. And there's a lot of electric elephant noises as he goes past subway stuff and then finally gets out of there. But Miles goes to a costume shop and buys a Spider-Man costume from Stan Lee, who's making a cameo as an animated character in this. Miles asks if he can return it if it doesn't fit. And Stan Lee says it always fits eventually, and then points to the no return sign, which I feel like is probably one of the more perfect Stan Lee cameos. Because it sort of encapsulates a lot of things about his character. But so Stan Lee does that, and then Miles goes to the memorial. Everybody's dressed up as Spider-Man in very bad Halloween costumes, and they're all witnessing Mary Jane talk about like how important Peter was, etc. And This is all stirring motivation for things. And so he decides that he's got to do this mission that he made this promise to Peter Parker that he's going to use this override key. And so he tries to train himself and jump off the building from the roof. And then he decides not to do that. So he goes down to a lower floor. And then he falls and then busts everything and then breaks the override key.
Bad move, Miles.
Yeah, and then he really should have not had that on his person like that. But he goes...
Yeah, for real. Has he not heard that two is one, one is none?
Yes. And one flying off a building is definitely none. But he...
Although, to be fair, he is in middle school, so...
Yeah, he's not...
Lesson learned. He probably won't make that mistake again.
No, definitely not.
Probably.
You know, how much did you really know about backup and file safety and protection stuff back then? Anyway, so he is like, well, this is a bummer. And so he goes to the grave of Peter Parker, and he's talking to the gravestone about how he's let Peter down, that he broke the thing, and that he can't do the promisey thing, and that everybody's gonna like that everybody's counting on him, and he's not able to do it. And this is when a shadow comes over his shoulder, and we are introduced to Peter B. Parker, who Miles electrocutes. And we're like, wait, Spider-Man doesn't electrocute people. This doesn't happen. But he tases him, bro. And then we get the introduction to the origin story montage of Peter B. Parker, which is, what's his name? Something Johnson? Jake Johnson?
Jake Johnson.
Yeah. And Nick
Miller from New Girl.
Yeah, the Jurassic Park guy. And
Jurassic World guy,
whatever. He had the Jurassic Park t-shirt. And so yes. They do the thing for him. And there's a very marked difference between his origin story as Peter B. Parker and Chris Pine's Peter Parker story. I appreciate that. Like, he got hit by a drone. he made some unsound investments.
TGI Spidey's was pretty good.
Yes. That he's, you know, separated from his wife, but he's handling it really well. And he's crying in the shower in his Spider-Man costume.
And then just sleeping like face down on an uncovered mattress on the floor in his New York apartment. And all of his stuff is still in boxes and hasn't really done anything with it.
Yeah. And then he's like, but you know, I was doing push-ups, getting strong, and he's eating the pizza, and then the portal to another dimension opens up, and then he tries to hold on to the pizza while he's sucked into the portal to the other dimension.
It's so great. He's like, to be honest, a lot of weird stuff happens to me, so this one was just a weird thing that happened. And he's just like, well, huh, dots, and I'm eating his pizza, and then yeah, as he gets sucked up, the pizza gets stuck to the ceiling and then falls back down. That was a nice bit of direction and animation.
Mm-hmm. And so he winds up in a different Times Square, and as you pointed out, there's different billboards and stuff for things, and so he's not used to that. But he has his costume, with the exception of having sweatpants on, and he's not initially sure what to do. He sees the image in on one of these Times Square billboards of the news of Peter Parker's death, and he's like, I saw, you know, my face, like it was me, but blonde, and you know, it was really perfect. It was like looking into a mirror. And then he takes off his mask, and he's all like bruised and beaten up, and not looking so hot. Then he goes to the thing, and then he gets electrocuted by Miles, and he's like, and that's where we are, and I want to know the rest of the story, you know, because he's the narrator explaining something, supposedly like inserted into this film, like he has no idea what's happening next. And this is when police officers show up, and Miles is attached to Peter by virtue of the webbing that Peter had shot before he was unconscious, like sort of as a reaction, I guess. And so they're tethered together, and he's trying to carry Peter's body, and they're like, put the body down,
it's like an extended like Charlie Chaplin comic animated sequence here where he's like running away, and then they're getting caught on stuff, and they're shooting webs and getting attached to the trains that are then yanking them both, and then they're flying through traffic and getting caught on light poles, and Peter B. Parker is still unconscious the whole time. He's like kind of sort of waking up, but not really, and just continues to smack into things.
Yeah, he wakes up for the important stuff, like hitting his own headstone. But they get through that whole ordeal, And then Peter wakes up and he's tied up to the punching bag that was in Uncle Aaron's bachelor pad. And Peter is like, well, Miles is like, yeah, I'm going to interrogate you. And Peter's like, watch the hands, whatever. And so he gets out of there and he's like, I'm not going to help you. I'm not going to do anything for you. I have no responsibility. Let me take the goober. And he's like, it's called an override key. And he's like, whatever, it's a goober. And he goes out and he realizes that it's broken. He's like, I have to make another one. And Miles tells him some more information about, like, it's under Fist Tower, all this other stuff. And Peter B. Parker's like, oh, well, you know, you just make another one of these and then I'll go back to my own dimension. And Miles is like, well, Peter Parker said you can't do that, otherwise it could open a black hole and be the end of everything. And he's like, well, you know, they always say that, but there's a lot of time between, you know, the end of everything where you can always try to do some of my best work. And it's a pretty decent line. And then he doesn't want to take Miles along, but Miles is like, you got to do it because you're going to train me and I got to be a Spider-Man.
But the other Peter said he was going to train me. He's like, yeah, well, I don't care. I'm not him. Yeah. But he guilt him into it, and he has a... I like the way this scene is, I guess, not shot, because it's not shot, but the way they're sort of just, like, casually walking down the sides of buildings and then up the other side of the building, and the way the camera turns at the 90 degrees to sort of give you a different perspective depending on where they're walking. And he just kind of, like, squats down and gets all sad on the side of a building, and Peter Parker looks over and just says, all right, fine, whatever, you can come along.
Yeah. It's the kind of thing that you normally wouldn't think to do in live action because it would be annoying to stage it. Even if you were planning on doing visual effects, it would just be an irritation.
And it would look incredibly cheesy. Even if you, I mean, it would look like the original Batmans where they were walking up the side of a building that wasn't a real building.
Yeah, but it works in this because the whole universe is fake. So it's not like you're cutting from something real to something fake or something that seems artificial, but or seems unreal. Because this is all just as real as anything else. And so he's, Peter B. Parker says, there's no time to waste. And so then they go to the hamburger place, that closed 6 years ago in his universe. And, he's eating french fries.
Where would you go if you were in an alternate universe that was similar to yours, but had restaurants that had previously closed?
I don't know. I can't think of anything in Los Angeles that I need to revisit that has closed.
Mm. I feel the same way, but I would probably just go to the Jack in the Box on the corner because it's been gone for 12 years. It's just been an empty Jack in the Box, and it would really be nice if there was food in a close proximity that wasn't just McDonald's or Filiberto's.
Dan?
Yeah.
I have never seen an economically depressed neighborhood where a Jack in the Box has closed. Like there's always either a Jack in the Box or there's no Jack in the Box. There's never a closed Jack in the Box.
There was a McDonald's, a Burger King, and a Jack in the Box. The Burger King closed first. It was empty for a year or two before it turned into Filiberto's, and then Jack in the Box eventually closed, and it has been empty for legitimately like 10-12 years. And now there is a sign up that says it's going to be a place called Eat Fresh. Like, it looks like somebody printed out the sign in Microsoft Word, because it says like all day breakfast, salads, gyros, burgers, it's chicken sandwich. It's like, wait, did you just put all of the foods you could think of on this board here?
Oh,
and you're gonna take over the old Jack in the Box and be something called, no, it's not called Eat Fresh, it's called Eat Smart, which just sounds fake. No,
that's not gonna last.
It's just a big white sign with red text on it. It doesn't have a logo.
No, it's not gonna last. That's somebody's dream of opening up a thing, and then they just are gonna like put everything into it, and then it's gonna close in 6 months.
Yeah. Meanwhile, our one real restaurant is closing because like the rent went up, and they're like, we have two other locations now. We started in your neighborhood, but it's too expensive here, so we're just gonna close and go away.
Is this that Clubhouse one that was having the water problems?
No, that one closed a long time ago, but that one's gonna reopen in the coffee shop that opened in the abandoned Hollywood Video that then also closed because it was like, I don't know how they were trying to make rent on just selling $6 lattes and frozen croissants that they bought from somebody else on the other side of town.
Wait, was that Where You Been, or was that something else?
No, this is Sun Cup. Where You Been is further
Sun
away.
Sun Cup. Okay, well. Dan?
Yeah, we had like four or five restaurants in our close proximity now over here, and now we have like three, I think, including the McDonald's. I think we have three.
You live in a dystopian hellscape.
it's true. We're gonna get an Eat Smart, and I think Biscuits, the place that was at the golf course, is going to, yeah, they're going to come back and take over the empty coffee shop that used to be the empty Hollywood Video.
Okay. Well, so if you could go back to Hollywood Video, would you?
I did like the Hollywood Video. It was very spacious, and it was bigger than the Blockbuster that was across the street from it, which turned into a Great Clips / karate place. And then the bank, the Washington Mutual, turned into a Froyo place called Yoasis.
Wow.
Yeah. I just remembered what it would be. It would be TC Luigi's, the pizza place that was next to the Water and Ice, and it was like one of the few places where you could get like a New York style slice of pizza, and it was actually really good. We went there in middle school because it was between the school and my home.
Sorry, did you say next to the Water and Ice?
Yeah. Do you guys have Water and Ices?
I mean, I have water and I have ice.
No, it's a place called Water and Ice where you can go in and refill the 5-gallon like Sparklets jugs or whatever, do it yourself kind of thing. And they have all of the candy. So kids would go in there and just buy like, you know, Atomic Warheads or whatever the hell you wanted at the time. And then they eventually had ice cream. So they had refillable jugs of water, all of the candy, and then some ice cream.
Intriguing.
It has been there for 30 years, and it is still in business.
Well, they nailed the business model.
They said they sell three things. They sell water, candy, and ice cream.
Yeah. And so anyway, Peter has his sloppy burger, and then they are going to go up to Hudson Valley to the Research Center for Alchemex, the lab. And what I like about this is Miles is like, you can teach me how to swing there. And he's like, what are you talking about? You take the bus. Why would I swing all the way up there? And so they do. They take the bus to Hudson Valley, and then they hop off, and they go to Alchemex, and there's disputes over capes and costumes. And then they are looking over the thing, and Peter B. Parker says, what would I do to get in there? And he's going to go do it. And he talks about how he's going to get a bagel on his way out. And so he does. But then Miles sees Kingpin pull up. And he freaks out because this was not part of the plan. Because now Peter...
He says, I can't bury another Spider-Man in his best Michael Caine accent.
Oh, man, that would have been so funny. I buried 14 Spider-Mans.
I want to see Michael Caine in that like kid's Spider-Man outfit with the little tie strings to hold the hood on and say, I'm not gonna bury any more Spider-Mans, and then sneak in to go save Peter B. Parker.
Yeah. And so he does, so that they bump
into... You trusted me, and I let you down.
Oh.
Big, flabby British body swinging from the Spider-Man webs.
Hey, that's not very nice. But they,
he's very old. He's allowed to be.
But they bump into each other in the air duct, and Miles explains that Kingpin is there and it's a problem, and Peter's like, no problem. And so they look over the vent thing down into this lady's lab, and he's like, I saw her on the interdimensional video we watched in class. It's an interesting school that he goes to. It is a lady, a scientist lady, explaining to Kingpin that the test did this, and then Kingpin demands that they do it in 24 hours, and you know, Peter B. Parker calls him on it because that's one of the stereotypes of this medium. Which is one of those things that this movie does, is it points out a lot of the meta stereotype-y things, kind of like your 21 Jump Streets and your 22 Jump Streets and your Lego movies do. And so they observe the lady type into her password, and then the lady and Kingpin leave, and so Peter goes down into the lab to go type in the password, and then Miles follows, but gets stuck on the light. And so then Peter tells him that he needs to relax and asks him what he does to relax. And so Miles starts singing and then falls off the ceiling. And Peter is very disappointed about this. And
but this is also when he discovers that he can do the invisible thing too, which is pretty dope.
Yes, yes. He gets up and then he can't see him and then he gets poked in the eye. And Peter's like, it must be some sort of like flight or fight response. And what I always find so weird about people who can turn invisible is that their clothes turn invisible. Not that I need it to be like Hollow Man where he should strip down naked, but it's one of those things where it's just like, that doesn't make any sense, because then when he's carrying the computer, would the computer turn invisible? Or when he's holding like the little like the goober, like wouldn't the goober be invisible? Like why? I don't know. But anyway, he does the thing, but he can't get the files off the thing, so they're going to take the whole computer. But while he's doing the computer thing, the lady doctor lady comes back in, and she sees Spider-Man, and she's this is super excited about the scenario, and it's weird because, like, why is she so excited? And then she's like, oh, your atoms are decomposing, and like when your cells are decomposing, and like you're gonna die, it's gonna be so excruciating, and I can't wait to watch. And then there's sort of a beat where it's like, what? And Peter B. Parker asks, I'm sorry, I didn't catch your name. And she says, oh, Olivia Octavia, Dr. Olivia Octavia. And then he's just like, and she's like, my friends call me Liv. And she's like, do your friends call you Doc Ock? And she's, no, my friends call me Liv. My enemies call me Doc Ock. And she's got all the little like arm things, but they're like inflatable tubes, like wacky arm flailing inflatable tube lady. And
it's a good look. It's probably a lot more portable than the big metal ones.
Yes.
That stick needles into your spine.
Certainly fits into a more svelte containment system than Alfred Molina's weird hunchback looking thing. So this is a surprise, and there's a fight, and Miles gets out of there with the computer, and he's hauling the computer in the monitor, and there's a fight, and then Peter gets out of there and catches up with Miles, and he says, good news, and he takes the monitor from Miles. We don't need the monitor to
I like that part, because that's what you're thinking the whole time as he's running, like, why did you take the computer monitor? Throw that away.
Yeah. Well, I mean, that monitor is worth $6,000 probably. But they... Mm.
You think she needed a reference quality monitor to monitor her acceleration particle thingy-mabob?
Yeah, I mean, I don't know what color space they map her interdimensional physics to. It'd be hard to do it in just like your standard sRGB.
You really need that 10 bit per channel depth.
Yeah, so she's and then she's chasing after them, and then they get to the cafeteria, which Peter had talked about jokingly earlier that he was going to grab a bagel on his way out, and he's like, Miles, can you turn invisible? He says, nope. And he's like, okay, well then just act real casual. I'm going to grab a bagel, and then we're going to walk out.
the scientists, they turn and stare at him, and they all like pull bazookas out from under the table or whatever the hell that was.
Yeah, the laser bazookas. I'm surprised that they carry that kind of stuff just like around, but they start unloading on him, and this is when they go outside the window, and one of the very gif-able, humorous moments in this movie, where Miles throws the bagel at one of the security guards that's chasing after them, and it hits the guy on the head, and then the text bagel is there briefly on screen, they start swinging out of there, and Peter says, do what I taught you, and he's, you didn't teach me anything, and then so they start teaching him as they're escaping.
Yeah, he's like this, you know, it's always the best way to learn is in the middle of your first life and death fleeing situation or something.
Yeah, and so then they escape the scientists, and then Doc Ock is there, and they're in deep doo-doo, and then all of a sudden another spider person shows up, and it's Spider-Gwen, and she beats up Doc Ock and takes back the computer, and goes and talks to them, and they all get out of there, and there is a origin story montage, and her universe looks a little different, which is also a nice thing, where it's like, it doesn't all need to look like this universe. Like, Peter B. Parker's universe and this universe, like, in terms of the fundamental appearance, look the same. But this is the first time you get introduced to something where, like, the universe seems like it's made of different stuff. And so you get this interesting, smeary pink and teal and blue and purple universe, and she talks about her best friend and stuff, and you see her like kick the shadow of a lizard person that turns into a person, and then she goes up and there's Peter there, and she's like, I lost my best friend. And I didn't catch this the first time I watched the movie. It was like, oh, she beat up the lizard, and then, oh no, Peter died. Why'd Peter die? And then later it occurred to me on talking to other people that it was the same person. I didn't really read like that to me at the time.
Oh, he was the lizard?
He was the lizard in that universe. Oh.
I didn't get that. I was like, are they doing a thing like Amazing 2 where he fell down the clock tower shaft or whatever?
No, yeah. See,
but I guess he was shirtless because Big Lizard Guy would have hulked out and lost his shirt.
Yeah, and if you watch it again, you can see the little lizard scales that they put on Peter's skin. But like when you're just watching this the first time in the movie theater, it may not register for most people, especially if
It did not register.
Yeah. And this is apparently pulled from the Spider-Gwen source material of her alternate universe stuff that exists in the comics, that he was apparently the scientist who turned into the lizard in that universe. And then she was the one who's bitten by the spider.
Interesting.
Yeah. And so,
wouldn't it make more sense if he was more of the Green Goblin? Cause they were friends, whatever. It doesn't matter.
Yeah, well, Dr. Kurt Connors was a scientist who just, you know, went a little overboard. And, you know, Peter has the potential to do that, I guess, if he'd gone down a different path. So it makes sense. And Norman
Because he had lost his arm and he wanted to regenerate it.
Yeah, and Norman had monies, lots of monies. So a lot of spending monies on, you know, Green Goblin stuff. But it makes sense. But anyway, they do the origin story, and then they're on the bus, and then they have their little moment of connecting over the goober that they got to go fix, and she knows the place to go do it, and it's Aunt May's house, and they arrive in Queens, and Aunt May is Lily Tomlin, and she has a bat, and she's going to beat them up, but she drops her bat, and Peter doesn't really want to meet Aunt May because his Aunt May had died years ago, but he sees her, and then they have a tender moment, and then she's like, well, come on inside. You know, I'll fix the goober. And they go to the shed.
You think it's a little weird that Aunt May isn't super duper freaked out by the fact that Peter's still there and also from an alternate dimension and old and kind of fat?
Well, I don't really appreciate... I have to say that the fat joke's kind of... Nah. You could say, like, you don't seem like you're in good shape or something for being a superhero, but, like... or that you're very active as a superhero, but I feel like the like your thick stuff, THICC is not very nice.
When you go see your far off relatives at the holiday, and they're like, oh, look at you, and they poke you in the stomach or something. You're like, let's not do that.
Oh, but so they go to the shed, and Peter's like, I got one of these, and then the door illuminates and opens up, and then it reveals the Batman as Spider Cave kind of thing.
So regular Peter Parker was a bit more successful both in his personal life and professional life than Peter B. Parker.
Yeah, I'm not really sure how he excavated this, but whatever. So they go down there, and you basically have the Bat Cave as seen in Lego Batman, which I don't know if you saw, but like there's like the rows of different costumes of different eras and stuff in the background.
Yes.
And so they do the thing, and one of the nice things here is Miles is looking at all the costumes, and his reflection in the glass in front of the costume does not line up with the eyes, but then when he goes back here later in the movie, his reflection lines up with the eyes, so that it looks like he's ready to be Spider-Man, and here it looks like he's not ready to be Spider-Man. So it's just a little, you know, direction thing.
Cinematic subtlety and foreshadowing and what have you.
Yeah, this is just the fun stuff that you can do when you can control everything you're seeing. But they have everybody in the room, and they're talking about the stuff, and it's like, well, we can't do this by ourselves. And then Aunt May has what I think might be the weakest joke in the movie, where she's like, oh, well, you think you're the only ones? You know, here, take these. And she hands out, like, hello, my name is badges and markers. I don't think they needed the physical comedy beat of handing that out, because it doesn't make any sense. She was just, like, carrying them with her. They could have just panned up to the reveal. And so you get the reveal of Spider-Man Noir, and... Peter B. Parker says, where's the wind coming from? We're in a basement. wherever I am, there's always wind, and the wind smells like rain. But this is, you know, that's why you hire Nicolas Cage, I guess. And you get Penny Parker, and you get Spider-Ham, and they say this couldn't get any weirder, and he says, "Yes, it can. I just wash my hands. This is why my hands are wet. No other reason."
No other reason. Oh God, John Mulaney. He makes a good spider pig.
Yeah, if you there's a YouTube video where he was on, I think, Jimmy Kimmel or something, where he has like an outtake video that they played on the Jimmy Kimmel show of like all of the like him just cursing as Spider-Ham back before they knew that he would not be doing that, but because they're like, yeah, you can just go ahead and riff, and so he was just like riffing but using curse words. So that exists in the world if you want to hear John Mulaney in his Spider-Ham voice.
I do want to hear that
riffing. But so they're like, we got to do the thing, and it's like, oh, well, one of us has got to stay and die. And then Miles is like, it's got to be me because I'm from here and you guys will all die like if you stay here, so you guys got to go. And they're like, well, we got to train you and make sure you're able of doing this thing. And then he's not up to standards, and then so he gets sad and he leaves on the elevator and turns invisible, and Peter Parker's like, I see, I told you he could turn invisible, and he leaves.
It's great when Peter Parker's trying to like sell everyone on him. He's like, he can do this and many more things, and no, just those things. And just those things. Jake Johnson's a very good sad, lazy Spider-Man.
Oh, he was perfectly cast for this. This is the role he was born for. But he decides that he's going to go to Uncle Aaron, who he has not been able to get in touch with, and he wants to tell him about this situation and how he's overwhelmed by this, and
he wants to vent to somebody. He's not having a great time communicating with his dad, and he doesn't really have any friends, so it's his buddy that he hangs out with and does questionable things with.
Yeah, but he arrives and Uncle Aaron's still not there, still not answering, so he writes down a note, and then somebody's coming, and so he hides, and the somebody who is coming is the Prowler, and so Spider-Man's all freaked out, and he's like, oh no, why would the Prowler be coming here? He doesn't say that, but he hides and then turns invisible, and then the Prowler is looking around all around, but his predator vision is not calibrated for heat or something, so he doesn't see him, and Miles scoots out, but the act of scooting alerts the Prowler, and so the Prowler pursues. And Miles knows that now his uncle Aaron is the Prowler, and so he's freaking out, and he's trying to get away. There's the whole thing with like a chase out on the street, where he's dodging in between crashing vehicles and gets out the other side, but the Prowler sees him from above, and Miles doesn't see the Prowler, so he thinks he's fine, so he goes back to Aunt May's, not realizing that he has led the Prowler and thus all of the other Kingpin enemies to Aunt May's place. And so then you get a big old battle here with Liv and
a lot of yelling, please take it outside, you're destroying poor Aunt May's house.
Yeah. And Nicolas Cage, what is it? He says, we don't pick the ballroom, we just dance or something. Like, he's the weirdest lines. There's another one about like punching a turtle or something. He's such strange lines, and you biscuit boxer and things like that. It's interesting.
I like to imagine he ad-libbed or just made all of that stuff up.
I don't know. I mean, he might have just had like a list of options, and he's like, I like this one. But it's entertaining nonetheless. And so they have a big old fight, and they're breaking stuff, and everybody's trying to fight back, but you got the Scorpion versus Penny, and Spider-Ham is there doing other stuff, and then all this other stuff, and Spider-Gwen versus everybody else and the things, and so then they get on the roof, and there's fighting on the rooftops, and there's tossing around the goober, because the one thing you want to do is everything relies on you having a USB key, is that you want to make one of them. Because USBs are notoriously difficult to source parts for and to manufacture.
Well, they built it like out of pieces and parts, so it was clearly more important than just a
USB key. Yeah, but like, yeah. Make two. Like, Like, what? Why would you make just one? Like, if you
make as many as you could possibly carry.
Yeah, like if you go out to do this mission and then like it falls out of your pocket, like what are you going to do then? Like, that had nothing to do with like an evil villain's plan. It just like literally fell out of your pocket because it's a tiny piece of plastic and silicon. Whatever. They have the fight thing, and then the Prowler, they're up on the roof, and then the Prowler is choking Miles, and he takes off his mask and reveals to Uncle Aaron, and Uncle Aaron's like, oh no, Miles, and then he lets him go, and then Kingpin is sitting in his limo, and he's like, why are you letting go? And then shoots him for not taking care of Spider-Man. And so this is an intense moment, and then Miles drags his uncle off to an alley somewhere else nearby and talks to his uncle before he dies, and then his dad shows up because he was called due to the disturbance of several spider people, and his dad chases away Spider-Man and sees his dead brother there on the alley thing. Mm-hmm. So this is a big emotional moment for them,
everybody. Yeah.
And so,
and of course, he thinks Spider-Man did it.
Yeah. And Miles goes to his school's dorm room, where he, all the other people show up because they need the thing that he has. And they all talk to him and they're like, you can't go on the mission thing. Like, you're not really good at this. And then they do the whole thing of them up on the ceiling, scooting back and forth. And then the roommate passes out. I like that. But
it's pretty good too, because that's from it's from Homecoming, I guess, right? With the roommate noticing.
Yeah. Yeah. Well, this was in production before that thing had happened. But they
I feel like this particular bit is in all of the Spider-Man movies, basically.
But I like that they all move in unison together as one like blob, and they're all like different animation styles, but they all just kind of like stick together.
One of the better jokes that was also in the trailer, but still works here, which is the
do animals talk
in this universe? I don't want to freak him out, and passes out.
Yeah, and they say like, yeah, no, you can't go do this thing, and then Miles is like, I can do the thing, and he's like, nope, and then he sticks them all full of webbing onto a chair, and then puts webbing over his mouth, and then leaves. And so Miles is just stuck there. And then this is when Miles' dad shows up and he knocks on the door, but it's locked and Miles can't open it or do anything. But he can see the shadow moving around inside. And so Miles' dad explains that Uncle Aaron, blah, 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 stuff. And so Miles is sad. And then Miles uses his electroshocky stuff to blow up the webbing. I don't think that's really how electricity works, but whatever.
He's finally able to focus his powers, but it's kind of amazing how the conversation through the door with the dad, like, they managed to find a motivated story mechanism for him to physically be unable to actually talk to his dad, or just sort of say like, I know, or to reassure him, or just to say anything. Like, he's got webbing over his mouth, like he can't do anything, and just to let that scene play out that way, it was actually well planned.
Yeah, and you got Mahershala Ali as the dad, so you could do worse. And then Miles, once he's freed, makes up his mind that he's gonna go take care of this, and he's gonna go to Aunt May and get suited up and get his stuff so that he can go do his thing. Meanwhile, everybody else takes 10 million years to go to Fisk Tower, because what Miles is doing is not an abbreviated course of action. This is one of the things that I find does not exactly flow smoothly for me, is like how the time works in this part, because it's like they leave his place and presumably go to Fisk Tower afterwards, but how that takes them as much time as it I guess it syncs back up again later, so maybe it does make sense, but anyway, it feels weird in the moment. They're disjointed because they're just arriving to Fisk Tower. Meanwhile, he's like jumping off of a building and learning how to, control his ability to stick to the building and do all
right.
this stuff.
He gets a suit. He talks to Aunt May. He gets his groove back.
Yes. Yes. How Miles got his groove back. And he goes off towards doing the thing. And then they're all on a construction crane looking at Fisk Tower. And then they're like, we got to do this thing. Glitch, glitch, glitch. And then they go in, they see through the skylight that there's a dinner being organized in honor of Peter Parker, and that all the waiters are dressed as Spider-Man. So they're like, well, this is convenient, because we'll just put on a tux or whatever in the waiter section. So they do that. And this is a very contrived scene where it's about getting Peter B. Parker to talk to Mary Jane because he's estranged from his wife, Mary Jane, in his universe. So he feels regret and sees this Mary Jane and wants to, you know, like fix it, I guess, and make her feel better. But it winds up being about like, yes, I'll get bread for your table. And they get out of there and they're not going to get the bread for the table. And they use the secret elevator that goes down to the lab thing part stuff. And they're going to go break the collider. The collider starts, and this is when wacky stuff starts happening. All the colors go super wild. And I should point out that this is 30 minutes from the end of the movie. The collider scene takes 30 minutes. It is in an enormous chunk of time when you think about it. Like, just this final thing. Because it's not even like a final battle where it's all fighting. Like, there's a lot of stuff that happens in here that's not really fighting, but it's all in the scene.
Yeah, I was trying to figure that out as they were going along. It's like, well, they're here, the collider's on, they're supposed to go back to their universes, but it's like, if they'll go back to their universes, they can't have a big battle where, like, six of them fight all of Kingpin's henchmen, so there's got to be a little bit of a delay here or something, right? So they can all have their fight and then they can go back.
Yeah, so they fight and then they have emotional tender moments and they fight some more. And so they're all in there doing stuff, trying to get the thingy up to the thingy to turn it off because there's that port that's on the ceiling, and all the henchmen are interfering, including all the other
villains.
Stuff is just
getting like progressively more wacky and colorful, and clones of every building coming out in different directions, Inception style.
Well, the building stuff doesn't start until after Miles gets there. And Miles does a little intro of curling up one of Doc Ock's inflatable tentacles and then punching her in the face with it. And then
there's a good entrance too, because yeah, he's got his invisibility.
And it reveals that he's in control of his powers. And so he does that. And he helps everybody out, and they slowly, one by one, defeat the henchmen by helping each other to defeat them. Like, the Scorpion destroys the mech suit that Penny has, but Spider-Ham shows up, and Scorpion dismissively says that he's a cartoon, and that's when he beats him up with a cartoon hammer. Anyway, that's nice. And you have more fighting and things, and then the universes finally start to do the thingy that's bad. And you get the buildings all swimming out of this vortex in the middle, this bubble of smaller bubbles.
But the
3D Kirby dots that look like a lava lamp.
Yeah, it does look like a lava lamp. Peter B. Parker was correct that there is there's plenty of time between starting up the collider and black hole that ends the universe, and that's where he has his opportunity to be Spider-Man.
Yeah, and so they finally put the thing in, and they get control of the collider. I went past an important part. When all this stuff is swimming around, and they're fighting Doc Ock, and it's crazy, and she's like using her arms to go in between buildings and going after them, and they're like, this is going to take a while, and then a truck hits her. And then I like the cut to Peter B. Parker with one hand over his mouth, just like in shock that he says she got hit by a truck.
Uh-huh.
Oh, it's funny.
It's pretty good.
Yeah, and so they go to do the switch thing, they do the switch, and they all start slowly going back one by one, Penny first, and Spider-Man Noir, and Spider-Ham, and Gwen, and then Peter B. Parker is like, we got to do the thing, and then Kingpin shows up, and Peter B. Parker is like, I'm not gonna go back to my universe, I gotta make sure that Kingpin, you know, is defeated and stuff. And Miles is like, this is BS, you just are procrastinating on dealing with the stuff in your universe, like, you don't want to go back there and deal with, sort out your issues. You know, Peter B. Parker says, I can't let Spider-Man die. And Miles says, I can't let him die again either. And so this is, I guess, your Michael Caine sequence.
Yes.
But you old 14 Spider-Men have died. But so they do the thing, and then Peter B. Parker goes back to his dimension because he's, he gets roundhouse kicked or something into his universe, and This leaves Miles and Kingpin, and Miles has to hit the green button, but Kingpin is prohibiting that, and things are getting wackier and wackier and more unstable, and then they get onto a subway train car thing, and you start to see these apparitions of Vanessa and Richard, the wife and son of Kingpin, materializing, and they're freaked out, and they're like, we gotta get away, like, from this, like, we can't be here. And
it's like glitching, but also replays of the actions from before, but also could be real reactions, because it's the same sort of situation that happened initially, where she's attempting to, or where he's attempting to attack Spider-Man.
Yeah, where they can't be involved in him being an evil bad guy. So they get out of that subway car.
Well, I don't know how you look at him and go, like, I'm sure he's just very lovable and friendly. He's not a big evil bad guy.
You guys don't know him. He's very sweet. So
don't judge a book by its 15-foot tall, 12-foot wide cover.
Yeah, everybody's got a type, so, you know, it's fine. I mean, I'm not going to judge what she finds interesting in a person, but so anyway, they leave. They
body
leave this
shaped like an SUV.
it's an interesting lyric for your rap song. But so they leave that train car and dematerialize, and the train car goes out of the blobby thing, and so then they're like fighting on the train car again, and then they're on top of the top of a Brooklyn Bridge, and Spider-Man gets beat up, and this whole entire time this fight has been happening, Miles' father has been slowly, progressively getting closer towards this lab, while it's been getting increasingly unstable, and he's all by himself. All of this seems very strange and contrived in order to get the scenes where Miles is inspired by his father in order to do stuff and to have his family and to have that inner strength so that he can get one up on Kingpin. And so when he gets the chance, he does the shoulder thing. He does the hey, and then zaps Kingpin, which causes him to fly through the air.
Yeah, it was good. He didn't realize that Spider-Man has electricity, because that's not a known Spider-Man feature up until this point.
Yeah, and so Kingpin goes flying, and then he gets webbed down, and then webbed slingshotted into the thingy to go push the green button, which I don't think is how green buttons work, but it triggers nonetheless the closure of the system, and so the whole system shuts down, the glitches stop happening, and everything sort of implodes. The fluoristomifer from Cloudy with a Chance of Meatballs goes through the little vortexy tube thing, and then all the other stuff gets kind of sucked into it, including the anvil, the cartoon anvil, and then it explodes. In the wreckage, Miles gets out of there, his dad's out of there, Kingpin is webbed up for being hauled off, and Miles calls his dad from his cell phone and says, like, he's sorry, you know, blah 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 blah, and the dad's like, I'm sorry, like, I, you know, things are crazy, like, I'm just glad you're okay. And it's a touching moment on split screen, and then Miles puts on his mask and then goes down and hugs his dad, but he's like,
and his dad very much doesn't catch the hint about what's happening.
No, he's like, thank you, officer. He gets out of there, and he gets his origin story here at the end of the movie, where he talks about how he got hit by a drone, and how he did all this other stuff, and he's the Spider-Man that protects everybody right now. You get a moment of him going to sleep, and then there's light on his face, and bubbly Kirby dot 3D Kirby dots appear, and you hear Gwen's voice again, and she says, Miles, and then it cuts to the credits, and you get wacky credits, which consist of a lot of 3D Geo being spawned and put in various places in lots of bright colors, and that goes on for a while, and then at the end of the credit sequence, you get Oscar Isaac as Spider-Man 20-something-something-9 or whatever. I don't remember. There was a cartoon briefly of this, and it was also a comic book before that. But there's Nuevo York in the far future, and he's the Spider-Man of that era, and he's a hologram assistant lady. And so she says that they've perfected a way for them to travel through alternate universes, and he says that he's going to go to, you know, Earth 67, and so he does.
He's going to start at the beginning. He's going to go all the way back.
and he appears in the Spider-Man cartoon from the 60s, like literally as like a cel-drawn kind of looking thing. He's not cel-drawn, but as if he were a cel-drawn. And this is the famous internet meme of Spider-Man pointing at Spider-Man.
Yes, the two Spider-Mans pointing at each other. Yeah. It's kind of amazing the way they turned that stupid little frame into Spider-Man arguing with himself and pointing at himself and arguing about who was pointing at who first, and all of the different old Spider-Man characters, like the newspaper guy and stuff, just standing there staring and trying to figure out what the hell is happening.
This is a very funny way to end it. And it, you know, it's perfectly on par with all the other meta nonsense that's been going on. So that's it. That's the end. That wraps it all up.
Mm-hmm. Spider-Verse.
Mm-hmm. In two.
It was an entertaining movie, and there's a lot of stuff in it, and it seems like it is capable of spawning additional Spider-Verse type related movies, but it's also, you know, clearly a lot of work to put this together, and I don't know if they have the time, energy, money, resources to keep going with this in like a Marvel-esque kind of way.
This movie was very well received. I think that Sony, as far as I know, is in progress on, I think, a direct sequel to this, but also a spinoff that's about Gwen. If I'm remembering this correctly, I don't have it in front of me, but from a few months ago, I think that's what it was. Is like, but this was not a tremendous financial success. It was not like a Marvel movie going in theaters,
right?
But it was a big success, like for Sony Pictures Animation, which has not seen a lot of big box office success. Like, as I said, I worked on Open Season. And I think it made $28 million domestic opening weekend, and that was considered an amazing disappointment at the time, which is kind of funny now because, like, I think most movies would kill for $28 million opening weekend. But anyway, that did not go well. But I was... I was partially inspired to revisit this because I'd seen this when it was in movie theaters. I was inspired to revisit this now that it's more widely available, and also because there are a bunch of people who have bad opinions about animation and what constitutes animation and things, and it just makes me angry. And
why don't they make a live action remake Spider-Verse? It'll be much better.
It's the evolution of
yeah.
Mm-hmm. And what you got to do is make a photorealistic 3D version that has no real human beings in it. And then that'll be like the ultimate F you to me. But
I don't know how we made it this far in 2019
as a society.
As a society, we made it all the way to 2019 with the Lion King, and that's the one that pushed everyone over the edge with their bad takes, saying, Look at this amazing live action version compared to the original 2D animated version, and wow, isn't it magnificent how far we've come? And it's like these things are not comparable because they're different things.
No one knows how anything is made. Like, they have zero idea. And
they assumed that the Lion King was made the way it was when it was made that way because that was the only option, and they couldn't have come up with anything else.
No. I mean, it's not like they had Babe. It's like, what was it, the year after or 2 years after?
Oh, man.
Yeah. No, anyway.
I liked that little pig.
But, I mean, The Lion King is the way it is because it's an animated, 2D animated movie that has a certain style, and it looks that way on purpose. Like, that's the way it's supposed to look. It's not an evolution to make a 3D version of it. And it's not an evolution to say, we're going to make a 3D version of it that is sort of hyper real, like not even photo real, but like we're gonna make a version where it seems like there's something that's like a lion but is more expressive than a lion, so it's not like a lion it's just nearish it is a really strange approach, and You know what? The movie might be fine. I have no particular interest in it. But it just really set me off when Rotten Tomatoes is like, this is the evolution of the 2D version of The Lion King. This is what
the way they,
20
they
years
the
can
two
get
together
you.
Side by side to say like, wow, look at the difference. Because obviously the trailer, they did a lot of like shot for shot remake style things. But again, it's not the same thing.
No, no. And it just perturbed me. There's a level of naivete that I expect from like most people, but if you're running a website that's about movie reviews, get your f-ing shit together. Like, do it. Like, don't just like be like, oh well, whatever. Like, you know, this is just the thing. Like, it's I can just be as completely knowledgeable about it as any other person on the street. It's like, no. You have a responsibility because everyone's going to mention you and say like, I saw this on Rotten Tomatoes, so it's true. You have abused your authority as an information source to spread something that is so mind-numbingly dumb, and does a disservice to all forms of animation. Because like this Spider-Man movie, like, it's not an evolution of 2D movies. It's not an evolution of a comic book. It's not an evolution of the live action Sam Raimi movies. Like, it is a complete entity that is informed by the decisions that are made in those things, but it is composed of artistic methods and means that are not like that thing plus one. Like, it is not an increment to get to this point where you're evolving over time. It is certainly advanced, but it is not like a linear path to get from some other previous earlier thing to here. It is looking at everything out there and making a new artistic piece and then saying like, look at this thing.
I don't know. That sounds like your opinion.
Anyway, so that's the end of that. We are out of the Spider-Verse.
I liked it. Mm-hmm. I'm going to watch it again because there are a lot of things, like a lot of Lord Miller movies. There are a lot of pieces to it that I assume will be enjoyable on additional viewings. And now that I own it, because you bought it for me, I can do that.
Listeners, just a funny piece of a funny little fact. There was a sale on this movie for a substantially reduced price, where I bought it for Dan as a gift because he hadn't seen it. And I wanted to make sure he watched it because I was fuming about animation stuff. And then literally the next morning I woke up and it was on Netflix for free. And I was just like, you buttholes. But
it's almost like it was on sale for a reason.
Yeah. The reason not known to me. But the important thing is that Dan can revisit this for the rest of his life and slowly peel back those oniony layers of this movie and enjoy it.
I do like onions.
I don't. And on that oniony note, we are done.
Hooray!
Yay!